Welcome to the Teamcast. I'm Dr. Preston Klein, Director of the Mission Critical Team Institute. Here, we discuss all things mission critical teams. These are teams of 4 to 12 people, indigenously trained and educated, who solve rapidly emerging, complex adaptive problem sets where the consequence of failure is death or catastrophic loss. With my colleagues and our guests, we bring you insights from combat zones to emergency rooms, dedicated to improving the success, survivability, and sustainability of these teams. We grapple with how to prepare for future events and how to develop language and frameworks to transfer critical, often unspoken, knowledge. Whether you're on a mission-critical team or not, we aim to bring you the broadest range of topics and guests as possible to help prepare you to perform when it matters most. Thank you for joining us and hope you enjoy the Teamcast.
Hi, folks. I'm Dan Dworkis, and my guest is Dr. Mark Ramsey. Mark is a cardiothoracic intensivist and an emergency medicine physician with over 20 years of experience, and he has fellowship training in both critical care and ultrasound. He is the co-editor-in-chief of Rebel EM, and if you don't already know about Rebel, which there's a strong chance you do, it's a widely respected blog and podcast focusing on bridging the gap between medical evidence and bedside care. And it is awesome. Mark is awesome. Mark, I am happy that you're here. Thank you for coming.
Thank you so much for having me, Dan. I've been looking so forward to this for a long time, especially when we first crossed paths a couple of months ago. And it just, so many discussions all the time can happen. So looking forward
to it. It's great. And we actually had a hard time nailing down like what we're going to talk about today. And I think we have a theme that's interesting, but there's just so many aspects of this that are worth digging into. And I love the way that you all describe Rebel as the bridge between the theory and the bedside. Because it's certainly how we see the Emergency Mind Project as well, right? Taking all of the ideas of stuff and moving it across that last mile, that conceptual last mile from like theory into action in a small group team.
Yeah. And one of my favorite things is to always have that practical and clinical approach. I think one of our first subheaders in our early posts was, how will this change my clinical practice? We've since removed that in our most recent posts and kept it as the clinical bottom line. But I think it's super relevant because it's like, what are you going to do tomorrow from reading this blog post or later on in your shift? And it really applies to being able to translate that knowledge into something really relevant for the provider and for the patient on the end.
So loosely, the direction we're going to take today is we're going to think about how teams make decisions under pressure. And we're going to set that off against the counterpoint of how individuals make decisions under pressure, which I think is a much more talked about and focused on realm. But often in medicine, the decisions that need to get made are team decisions. And that could be because nobody has enough knowledge to make the decision by themselves. That could be because there's competing forces in terms of needs and issues for the patient, or it could be a number of other reasons that are unrelated to any of that, but that's where we're going to go. So I'll start by asking, in your practice and in your history, when did you first start thinking about that kind of issue, about team decision-making?
Yeah, so I saw this pretty early on in fellowship, actually, where transitioning into now the role of a critical care fellow, you were now not just making the EM attending single decision, you are now having to consider the entire team. Even on rounds, you'd sometimes be joined with a pharmacist, you'd sometimes be joined with a respiratory therapist, a nutritionist. And now it wasn't just, this is what we're doing, and this is what the care plan is. It would be, nope. This is what I would like to do. And this is what I think my recommendation as the intensivist is, or budding intensivist at the time. And now I need to check in with some of these other key players in the room and in rounds to see where and how is that plan going to be modified. So for instance, if I wanted to get this patient duo nebs, maybe for whatever reason, the respiratory therapist has been running into issues with getting them to cooperate with holding up the tube because of just weakness or the actual treatment. Because of weakness. And now I need to actually rope in my physical therapy people and my rehab people. And so all of a sudden, it's now no longer you in isolation, singly making that decision, but it's now like a web of who else is involved and how is it going to impact patient care based on the treatment plan that I'm prescribing, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And did you spend time as an ER attending before going to critical care fellowship, or did you go straight through from training?
No, I went straight through, and we weren't allowed to moonlight in our first year of critical care fellowship, only in our second year.
Got it.
So yeah, I went straight through.
So that's really interesting because right there, we're looking at some of the different decision-making models that you see in medicine and that you see in teams of medicine, right? Because obviously the ER functions as a team as well, mm-hmm. but it can be much more sort of command and control, like hierarchical decision making, especially in the moments of like real crisis where leadership direction is often like, this is the direct, like we're going left, prepare to go left, right? Kind of thing is the decision we're making. For folks that don't spend a bunch of time in ICUs, can you press on that a little bit? Why would, and maybe it's the structure of an ICU or the type of patient or the medicine you're practicing, but why would that be a space where you would have a different decision making style?
Yeah, I think because there's a lot more players involved, and now mm-hmm. there's a lot of investment being made in the patient from their critical illness standpoint. Now, I'm biased in that I work in mainly a cardiothoracic ICU, right? And a cardiac ICU. And so I now have to really consider, what is the surgeon's perspective on this? Mm-hmm. What have they gone through from their operation that is impacting the decisions I have to make now? If you were to remove that cardiac or that cardiothoracic component to it and make it a medical ICU, you still have a very intricate team of individuals that all come with their own perspectives and all come with a mission of, I need to get this patient XYZ treatment or therapy, and I need to be able to make sure it fits in with the rest of those, or the rest of the physician taking care of the patient. So like physical therapy isn't just going to come, try to pick up a patient, get them to walk, and then leave. No, they're going to come check in, see when is the best time to do that. Same thing with physical, same thing with respiratory therapy. They're going to come in and see when is the best time to give those treatments, et cetera, et cetera. And so it's a little different from the ER in that your key players are different, as opposed to you still have nursing and then you still have your consultants, but now, and you still have respiratory therapy, but like rehab and nutrition aren't as much of a role in the emergency department. And then on top of that too, if you're in a subspecialty ICU, you don't have to worry about, or you would in that sense worry about a surgeon, right? And so all of these are impacting the end goal mission for the patient by having all of these different players weigh in on that. And I think that makes it different. It makes it different from the emergency department in that way.
And is that a story of different streams of knowledge needing to be combined? Like nobody has all of the skill sets by themselves, which is still true in the ER, but I'm trying to pull out the difference here. And I think part of the difference is the different streams of input. And part of the difference is the threshold we're putting on what we'd call the team level speed accuracy problem of making a decision, right? So in the ER, we're likely making decisions that are within the context of crisis. And if we extrapolate out the speed accuracy problem of making a decision, we're likely focused more on speed, right? Like we need things to happen immediately. The consequences of action taking are such that there's often not the opportunity to engage in a more democratic model of decision-making, or sometimes even a more informed model of decision-making. Right. We have to favor that speed. But in an intensive care unit, unless the patient is actively crashing, we have the opportunity to consider alternative forms of group decision-making.
So yes, I would totally agree with that. Now, but the other flip side in the ICU world is that it actually can become the extreme other side of paralysis through analysis, right? Of, oh, let us check in on this one thing before we make action, or let us check in with these people before we take action. And I find that EM trained intensivist, and again, maybe because I'm biased, is that we have a tendency to just want to get things done a little bit more with that speed from the emergency department, even in the ICU setting. And so a good example of that is oftentimes our ECMO patients will have lots of epistaxis and nosebleeds. And so to see what happens on the inpatient side of things is what's called ENT. Let's do this. Let's bubble. And you're just like, no, just give me a Rhino rocket. And then everyone's looking at you like, what the hell's a Rhino rocket? And they're just like, let's just handle this. We don't need to do that.
Sure.
And so that can sometimes be crippling to the ICU team, where now it's taking one, maybe 2 days to accomplish the same mission or task that if you were to explain that to an emergency physician, they would be like, why? Like, why just do it? Same thing, cardiac surgeons have that same mentality of just get it done. And so that, I think, plays a role into this paradigm that we're thinking about.
Okay, I think we've talked about this before a couple of times in the podcast, but this is going to lead us into a question about teams. But can you describe for folks open ICUs versus closed ICUs and how that might play into sort of what we're talking about here?
Yeah, totally. So I'll start with an open ICU. So an open ICU sometimes has been described to me as like the Wild West. It is just somebody can come in at any time, put in orders. And by anyone, I mean like a consultant of a cardiologist or a pulmonologist who intimately knows the patient well. Let's just say they know room 5 very well, like intimately in the outpatient setting. They can just come in and be like, oh, I know that this patient sometimes like certain medications when they are hospitalized. So they would just put in those orders. Now, they may or may not talk to the primary treatment team. And if they don't, then it's just like becomes, again, that little Wild West in that all of a sudden you have like random people putting in orders and you're not able to keep track of the treatment plan that you have already prescribed in the morning during rounds. So that's essentially an open ICU. A closed ICU is very different. A closed ICU is like no orders are allowed to be put in, essentially, except for by the primary treatment team. And yes, that includes that patient's pulmonologist or that patient's primary care doctor or hospitalist or whatever. It has to be run through the intensivist and the critical care team. Now, there are some exceptions to those kind of closed ICU rules. One great example is dialysis orders. You ask an intensivist to put in dialysis orders, they will look at you completely funny because they're like, I just talk to the nephrologist. So that's an exception where even if it's a closed ICU, the nephrologist can still put in dialysis orders on their own, but not necessarily anything else. It's just the specific like regimen of dialysis, if you will. And those nuances exist in other ICUs. Like again, in my cardiothoracic ICU, we have transplant patients. So heart failure makes modifications to the tacrolimus and a lot of the other immunotherapy or immunosuppressant drugs. And so that is done by them knowing that they can put in the orders through their pharmacist or whatever. But for the most part, it's still a closed ICU that only the intensivist can put in orders.
Awesome. So I want to make that even more basic for somebody listening to this, maybe from the military side or the oil and gas side or something like that, where we're thinking about decision-making. I'm going to take a stab at it and fix whatever I'm wrong at here. But open ICUs have a variety of individuals that can make decisions on behalf of the team. Those decisions might have specialized knowledge. Those operators might have specialized knowledge sets, but they don't necessarily have to understand the coherence of the whole picture for that patient.
Yeah.
And then on the other hand, a closed ICU is there's basically one leadership structure, one decision-making structure for the patient. Other people can advise that group, but it's just that one group who's then able to go in and run the coherence of the plan. And they might, for example, subset out part of their decision-making to an external group like dialysis for kidney doctors. But generally speaking, they own the plan. And so it's a method in the closed ICUs that favors, now I'm editorializing a little bit, but I would assume it favors systems level thinking, complexity level thinking, and plan coherence over individual options or individual movements in a plan.
Correct. And what we know is that this is likely better for critically ill patients. If you think about it,
The closed is better.
Okay. Because if you think about it, the emergency department is essentially a closed ICU.
Correct.
If you were working a shift and some random doctor came and put in orders, you'd be like, whoa, what's going on right now? And that's because you want that system-based overhead view of decision-making to be more centralized and not as chaotic as randomly putting in orders on anybody and any patient from any doctor. And that's, again, because you just want a little tighter control of the treatment plan of those really sick patients, whether they're sick or not. Like some can argue, yes, the fast track area of the emergency department is still part of the closed ICU and they may not be as sick. But sure. It's still the same idea, whereas the ICU is the same way. And you put it nicely in terms of how the leadership structure is based.
Yeah. So I read this book recently called Superminds by Thomas Malone, and it talks about the different ways that groups of individuals or groups of decision makers can come together to form these sort of like meta minds, or I guess that's the dumb way to put it, these super minds, right? So that's the name of the book.
Yeah.
He talks about how these different structures are effective in different parts of decision-making. And he sets apart these different classes for them. And we've talked about a couple of them. And this is an unformed thought that I'm going to throw out here, but we talked about hierarchies, right? Which are like, there's a single leader and then other people feed information to that leader and the leader makes the decision. We talked about democracies, which are some version of there's multiple people voting, and either it's group consensus or it's a democratically informed hierarchy or something like that, where there's some bridges between those. And then he sets out a couple of other tactics that don't really seem to show up in medicine. Markets, where people compete for, everybody does their own thing, and then collectively the group decides on the price or on the answer. And there's a little bit of that market structure in what we're describing for the open ICU, right? There's a bunch of different people who come in with their own opinions and they push their own agendas. And then there's some integrating function, which is usually the nursing staff that decides, wait, these are contradictory. I think I'm going to go with this plan and here's why. And there's a little bit of influence peddling that goes on. And there's a whole bunch of high school sort of stuff that goes on in the middle of that. And then he also talks about communities, which are ethically minded or morally minded or driven groups like that. And then ecosystems, which are combinations. But it strikes me that as we're getting at this, we've tried a bunch of different things. We've tried open ICUs. We've tried closed ICUs. We've tried hierarchical control. We've tried democracies, all of which are our attempts as the field of medicine to decide how should teams of people with different skill sets and different knowledge bases come together to make an optimal plan for a single sick individual. And that's a big, randomly moving thought, but I think it's going to take us back to this place of, in your experience, for the teams that you work with, how do you see that working? What do the best teams do when they're making decisions effectively? Is it democracy? Is it hierarchy? Is it a mix? What do the worst teams do? How do you move teams about how they make decisions? If you walk into an ICU and you don't like it, how do you change it? Man, take that any way you want to go with it.
Yeah, so a lot of points to unpack here. First, I would say, in my experience, democratizing it seems to be the best way. Now, that is always held with the bias of personality involvement, right? Yes, I think we've all been there where we're going to say, yes, as a team, we're going to decide and make a care plan that's everyone agrees upon. But then inadvertently and inevitably, the person who's the loudest or most forceful personality, if you will, is the one who tends to steer or direct the conversation. So a good example of that is on the ECMO team. We all have multidisciplinary people who make a decision about putting a patient on circuit. You have a heart failure, you have a critical care, and you have a surgeon. And, you know, I distinctly remember a couple months ago, it was like around 9 or 10 o'clock at night. And I was the intensivist the next morning in that same unit. And I was part of the decision-making about putting a patient on ECMO. And we all were trying to do the democratic game. And then I brought up a point of, we're all here right now, and due to resource limitations, it's probably best if we make this decision now and actually probably proceed with ECMO because of the fact of XYZ, right? Labs, data, et cetera. And the surgeon, as you can expect, has a personality and is pretty involved and was like, that is the most ridiculous reason in terms of resource utilization. Because to them, resources is like a small thing. It's not like, they're operating usually in a room that has infinite resource, or I shouldn't say infinite, but a lot of resource. So to them, that's not a factor. But to myself, who's an ER doc, who's also an intensivist, I'm like, no, that is a real factor. Because tomorrow morning at 8 or 9 a.m., if this patient has to go on ECMO, nobody of our team here now will be here to do this. And it will likely be just me. And so that's an example of how the personality can come out. Yes, it's meant to be democratic, but now the personalities come out to already steer or guide the conversation. And so, and in my experience, I think democratic is definitely the way to go.
And when you say democratic, take me through the decision-making that your team is making, or maybe other ICUs that you've seen. Are people voting? Are people like, are you polling the audience? Are you voicing opinions? How does that actually work? As we know, democracies mean a lot of things to a lot of different people.
Sure, sure. I'm going to explain just my own practice and my own experience because of the fact that I've seen so many other models where I'm just a fly on the wall and I'm just like, wow, I would never do that. But in my own model, I actually stop at the end of rounds and then I will go through each person to check in with them to see what their thoughts are and giving them that space to communicate about their opinion or experience or reflection or an agreement of the care plan. Now, that is and can sometimes be a little leading, right? what I've noticed happens a lot too is that they will just speak up if there's a problem. And I think it's probably because I've tried my very best to create that safe space for people to speak up. And an example is we're rounding and the nurse practitioner is talking to me about XYZ care plan. And I can just see the pharmacist like edging to say something. And I'm just like, go ahead. What are your thoughts? It looks like you want to say something. They'll be like, yeah, they're on XYZ of diuretic here and they should be on this diuretic. And it's almost like it becomes more of a real-time, multifaceted discussion of different components related to what we're talking about, as opposed to no pharmacist, you can't speak up until it's your turn, right? Or you get a vote, like when it's your chance to speak at the very end, then you can talk. Now, I still create that space. So at the end, I will literally say, well, I'll recap all of rounds. And then I'll say, well, our pharmacist happens to be one of them's named Amir. So I'll be like, Amir, what are your thoughts on this care plan? Do you have any other recommendations about that amlodipine or that Lasix that we're starting? And they will easily be like, yeah, I think we should do XYZ at that time too. I create that space in multiple avenues in order for people to be able to speak up, as opposed to being like, all right, everybody, we're going to have a vote. This is what we're going to do. And let me know if you don't agree. And then I will be like a tiebreaker or something.
Got it.
That's my approach.
And how does that plan transition when you're moving into more of a fast decision-making mode? So I think you're describing a really elegant method for making high stakes, but potentially low speed decisions.
Correct.
And like whether or not the decisions you're making in that method are reversible or irreversible, but you're making decisions where you have the opportunity to slowly integrate data, compare mental models with reality, and allow a better model to surface from the community. That's not always a luxury that we have. So how do you transition that if this has to be a fast decision?
Yeah. So if this ends up having to be a fast decision, what I will do is I will just speak out loud my own thoughts so that the whole team is on board as to what I'm thinking. And I've noticed the most chaotic codes or decision-making in high speed is often a result of the white knight or the superstar player that comes in and just starts doing things and doesn't necessarily tell the team what they're doing and why. And as a result, then everybody is left in the side and not able to keep up, if you will. And then that one like rogue person inevitably gets frustrated, right? Because things are just not happening at the speed that they want because they haven't brought the rest of the team on board. And so I tend to speak out loud. And when I do that, it actually offers a very good way to obtain safeguard information. So an example of that is if a patient is in an SVT and I want to give them a certain medication, like I'll just give them a beta blocker. The nurse or a nurse practitioner could be like, oh, yesterday they got 2.5 of low pressure and it like tanked their pressure. And then all of a sudden you're like, okay, or hold on a second. Let's not do that. Let's now have another little mini discussion as a result of it. Okay. Did this happen again? What were they given at that time? And all of a sudden it's now I'm lifting up the team and empowering them to be able to say, yes, I saw an error happen, or not an error, but I saw something happen previously and I want to prevent it from happening again. And now I'm going to help dictate their care. So why don't we give them XYZ, a calcium channel block or something like that? And then you're like, okay, great. We're going to do that.
So I love that because we're capitalizing not just on the diversity of skill sets and the diversity of training backgrounds, but also on the diversity of recent lived experience. Like people have gone through that. You might not have known that. You weren't there for that.
Yep.
Maybe it made it into the record somewhere until we get like really good universal recording of what happens. Stuff like that can easily just be missed. Like the nurse sees the blood pressure drop. So, you know, they support the patient appropriately, check it again, and it's gone away. And by the time the next recorded measurement comes around, and you're just like, that stuff is invisible unless you have a team that's out there thinking about that.
Now, with that said, though, we have the luxury in the ICU of following these patients and often having similar staff. So that is definitely a limitation and a caveat to applying that to the emergency department. Now, I have seen it in the high utilizers of the emergency department who come in and that person's, oh yeah, I know like that one nurse, I know that person, and this is what they usually are here for. Sure. But for the most part, I think that is certainly a benefit that the ICU has, is that continuity of both staff and patients that the ER doesn't, and therefore you're more suited to be able to do this. It's not saying that you can't in the emergency department, but you're just more suited in the ICU.
No, that makes sense. And underlying whether you're talking about this model in the ER, the ICU, right? Underlying what you're describing is the role of everybody, but particularly leadership, in creating psychological safety and creating the space for people to speak up and offer counter opinions. And I think it's too simple and too coarse-grained a thing to say that hierarchical systems don't have psychological safety and democratic systems do. That's overly simplistic.
Yeah.
But whether or not you're operating in more of a hierarchical mode or more of a democratic mode, you still have the responsibility and the option to build some of these structures into the teams that you're doing.
Yeah, and I think you can really apply that in very micro moments. Surgeons that I work with often have trained and currently operate in a very hierarchical structure. And so to get them to operate or to function more in that democratic mode often takes those micro moment coaching, or I guess that micro moment feedback, to be able to have them shift gears. We had an LVAD patient come out that had very high peak pressures on their ventilator. And the surgeon was like, this was a very critical moment of when they were transitioning them from the OR team to the ICU bed. And the surgeon who did the operation is at bedside, and he just kept yelling, "Somebody get me Duonems to help reduce the peak pressure." He just kept yelling, "Somebody." So I told him, I was like, "Dr. Blank, somebody means no one." And he literally looked at me, smiled, pointed, and was like, "Her name is Liza. That's the respiratory therapist." And he's like, "Liza, please get me Duonems." And it happened within a minute, right? And it's those micro moment coachings where I'm not coming at him like I'm a jerk to be like, "This is how you should talk," but I'm just letting him know, "Hey, by the way, you can keep yelling somebody, but Liza probably thinks Lisa's getting it, and Lisa probably thinks Ashley's getting it, and Ashley thinks Brian's getting it. So nobody's getting it, right?" Yeah. And we talk about this all the time in like closed loop communication and AC lesson codes, but it's those micro moments that actually you pick them up and you're like, "Yeah, no, this is where you apply that. And this is how you move towards a more democratic model." Even if you've operated and trained in a hierarchical model, you can still make progress and movements towards that democratic.
Let's keep poking at that. That's super interesting. So let's say I drop you tomorrow, I'm going to put you in charge of an ICU that has historically it's closed, but it's historically very hierarchically driven. It's completely personality driven by the 4 or 5 intensivists that are there. And you're the 6th intensivist. Welcome to the crew. And part of why we're bringing you in is to hope to change our culture around teamwork and decision-making, because we have this belief that more democratic models are probably better. So how do you do that?
Yeah. The first person I would beeline it to is the charge nurse. And I would not only beeline it to the charge nurse, but the like nursing supervisor of that unit. And I would ask, what are things that are impeding nursing from moving this unit forward or being able to speak up and empowering them to take more of a leadership or initiative role? So that would be the first thing I would do, is I would go after charge nurses in a good way to understand that, and where from them, as well as their nursing staff, they would be able to identify to me, out of the other 5 intensivists, who are the personalities that I would need to be aware of. So with that said, it's not in a bad way of, "Oh, who are the bad players or key players?" I just need data in terms of who's the one intensivist who stops us from being able to move patients, or stops us from being able to, or will always block an ICU admission or accept every single ICU admission. Like, I just need to know who maybe are the ones that are a little bit more difficult to work with or communicate with. And the best people poised to do that is the bedside nurse, because they're always there. They're always there. They're always interacting with these individuals. The next crew I would then go after to acquire data, I shouldn't say go after, is the nurse practitioners or the APPs, the mid-levels, the physician assistants. And again, that gives you a really good baseline, or I guess pulse, of where is this unit going in terms of, are they being trained? Are they being educated? Are they actually being treated as like second-class citizens, and there's a maybe scope creep, or there's some fear that they're going to take the intensivist job? It helps you understand what is their role and where is their role going and how they interact with the intensivist, because they're in an interesting position where they're not, maybe some of them were nurses, sure, if they're NPs, but they're not doing the bedside work immediately, but they're also not the one in charge.
Yeah.
And so that would be the next group I would go after. And then from there, I would probably pursue all of the subspecialty ancillary services that are needed to run a unit. So the ones that we had talked about before, respiratory therapist, nutrition, rehab, and I would actually do all of this without even leaving the ICU. I would find out who are the ones that come to the ICU, because the ones that actually, if you think about it, those are the, those services have a, as far as I'm aware, have a choice or have an assignment to the ICU. And so if they're already going to be working in a toxic ICU, those are often the first to go. They're often the first to say, I don't want to cover the ICU. I don't want to do that. When we had a transition leadership at one of my hospitals, we were switching from one unit to the other, and we had new leadership that was just not appreciated, and they were difficult to deal with. And the pharmacists were like, we're out, like we're done. And they're like, we will be the lung transplant pharmacists as opposed to the heart transplant pharmacists. And you're like, we're all in the same unit. I know what you guys are doing, but like, we're all in the same unit.
Yeah.
And so that's something important to keep in mind, is like, what is causing those services to not want to come to the unit, and
Sure. How
can we bring them back?
Yeah.
So that's my multimodal overview approach.
I love it. And okay, so then I'm going to stay on this line for 1 second and we'll jump off it. But
sure.
Okay, so you meet with all these people, you get a lay of the land, you understand a really good model of how the system works right now. And then you still say, okay, I need to now change this system. I need to nudge it towards doing more democratic decision making. And actually, I guess I should take a step back and go, well, no, let's keep going this, and then I'll jump on that. But like, how do you do that? How do you nudge teams to more decision-making? You figured out, here we are, here are the people that love hierarchical. What do you do now?
Yeah. So I would always start with low-hanging fruit. And a good example could be having a checklist at the end of the patient presentation, which is often been associated with quality metrics, which I actually hate that it's associated with it. But you would have the nurse be empowered to say, here, I would give that task to the nurse, assuming they have the bandwidth to do it. And this is why I would have, of course, checked in with the charge nursing and nursing leadership to see what is their bandwidth to be able to take on additional work for the betterment of the unit and moving it towards a democratic nature. There's a lot of different kinds of checklists, but whatever, we'll just use like the faster flags one or FLANS or whatever you want to use. They would then at the end say, go through from top to bottom and be able to use that as an opportunity, not only to speak out and speak up, but also to make sure certain things are actually being accomplished and that it's a level of accountability being held back indirectly to the intensivist. They would then be able to take that information, and then I think I would build in a part of follow-up. So yeah, we talk about it on rounds, but then we would want to make sure the afternoon rounds is still followed up upon. So I would tell them, you're going to talk about this checklist at the end of rounds to make sure that we hit everything. And then in the afternoon, by 3 or 4 o'clock, if there's still something on the checklist that hasn't been fulfilled or met based off of our plan, then like we should talk about it again. We should certainly go around again. Now, this would also imply that there's some level or structure of afternoon rounds. And if there's not, that would be something we'd also have to set up for. But this could actually help facilitate that afternoon round setup as well. So it serves as like a dual purpose. Now, that's just one small thing.
Sure.
Obviously, replicate it with whatever you want. And another really good one is mobility and just getting patients to move, right? Sure, you can build it into a checklist, but that in and of itself could be its own thing. You could easily have a structure and a like plan for getting patients out of bed to chair. And then now you are empowering the physical therapist to be able to speak up and say, why are there barriers to this? Yeah. So that's how I would go about it, as one or two small things, and then slowly keep escalating.
Perfect.
More and more things from there.
Perfect. So we're going to start with decisions that are not less important, but easier to reach. And we're going to start with decisions that are sometimes ignored. And we're going to take that and we're going to put those decisions up into the group's consciousness. And we're going to allow and encourage and request, really, that people weigh in on them from their different vantage points. And so essentially, we're going to build democratic decision making by practicing democratic decision making.
Correct. Because if you think about it, it's like any other muscle you'd want to get stronger. You want to keep those reps going and you want to do it in a consistent manner, so that everybody is on board with this new culture change. It is a culture change, right?
Yeah, totally.
You're going to totally have people who are like, why are we doing this? This is stupid. And that's fine. There's always going to be those naysayers, but those are often the people who might only see that initial period of time being wasted and not necessarily the bigger picture or end result or end goal, if that makes sense.
Yeah, because it's not obvious if you just write it on paper why having the entire group weigh in about moving a patient from bed to a chair would produce better life-saving decisions in a critically ill patient. But that's really the arc we're driving, is team decision-making is the most, is like a core feature of critical care. Effective team decision-making requires an ability to integrate multiple viewpoints and do democratic decision-making. That's a muscle that you have to practice. Practicing that starts somewhere. And that's your arc of logic from.
Yeah. And where I've seen this fail is where individuals force it and don't necessarily understand or appreciate the barriers that impede it from its success. In our cardiac ICU, in order to get patients like getting certain breathing therapies, we have a piece of paper that's been put up that says like when they're going to get this therapy every hour and what was done and et cetera. And when it doesn't happen, the surgeons visibly and verbally get very pissed off, but that's actually not the approach. It's you should understand why it's not happening. What is that respiratory therapist doing that is impeding them from doing it? And ironically, they're probably doing that Q1 hour lactate that you've ordered on your LVAD or at ABG that might not necessarily be necessary every 1 hour, right? It could be every 2 hours. And it's if you better understand that it's all connected, then you can better understand where the weak points are in other places of the unit. And when you put it in that way, then the surgeons, oh my God, then yeah, what, it doesn't matter about Q1 hour lactate. Let's just do Q2 because then, you know, bed four isn't getting their chest PT and their intensive spirometry and their respiratory therapy. And you're like, yeah, exactly, right? Like you only have so many people, so you can't have 5 respiratory therapy tasks for only 2 people. It's just not going to happen. By default, not going to happen.
No, I love that. There's so much in there about error versus error and like a fault-based mindset versus a more safety two based mindset of systems as sensors and like using discrepancies from expectation to model how systems actually work and thinking about work as done versus work as imagined and like how all of that plays into the, that's such an awesome story you just described right there. That's super rich.
I mean, that's totally like grounds for another podcast later on. Yeah, I'm totally down for it.
Absolutely. I'm wondering, we laid out this arc about essentially how to nudge critical care teams towards more democratic decision-making. In your role in the ICU or in your role at Rebel or anything else, have you seen groups that have studied this? Is there evidence behind this style of decision-making? I know there's stuff comparing open versus closed ICUs, but I don't know off the top of my head this kind of thing.
Yeah, I don't know off the top of my head, actually published information. I know a lot of this is ongoing right now. I remember as a fellow, they were actively recording us during rounds to see how we were physically making the decisions. But I don't know if they were catching how is that decision impacting the team and the unit being more democratic and closed.
Interesting.
The long-term consequences and plans of that. And obviously, if there is data and information on this, I would love to know about it and read about it, because this is also grounds for Rebel posts and Rebel publications for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a very much complex system theory feedback loop going on here, because and I think this is something that as a junior, I really did not understand, right? I really viewed this decision as this decision. And maybe I would understand that this decision might influence not just what decision we made, but how we made the decision would influence like later that shift, or maybe I could understand how it influenced in that patient. But to take the leap and be like, look, your team, your culture is understanding how you made this decision. And when you force it through in a certain way, that produces this feedback loop to the next style of decision you're going to get. It influences how likely or not likely people are to speak up, how likely or not likely they are to give you dissenting information. And some of this is just psychological safety, but it's also the concept of how much does our team believe in the decisions that we're making? How effective are we at encountering new scenarios? And this whole loop plays itself out so that it's not just about, was this the right decision for this person at this time? But if we think of the ICU, the critical care team, as an organism or a supermind or whatever you want to call it, like how are we getting better and evolving our ability to make decisions effectively?
Yeah, it's interesting you bring that up because, and this is a complete speculation and observation that I've noticed in the ER and the ICU, is that the care team, often usually nursing, will remove themselves from the care plan when describing it to other nurses or other healthcare professionals. So I've noticed this, like they'll say when they're on board with the care plan, and again, this is just complete speculation, my own personal observations, is that when they're on board with the care plan, they'll be like, yeah, we want to keep their blood pressure under systolic of 180, or we want to keep their heart, their MAP goals between 80 and 90 or something. But then when they don't agree, or when there's some dissonance or disagreement, they'll say, yeah, they want to keep the blood pressure between 80 and 90, or they want to do this. And you're like, who's they? Because we are all in this together. And like, we are all the ones who made this care plan together. And that applies probably more in the ICU where you have for the formal rounds and whatnot. But it still technically does apply in the emergency department. They're still part of the care team.
So that's really smart, Mark.
The wording changes. And then that's a very subtle way to be like, is there something else I need to dig into here? Is there something that maybe you don't necessarily agree with, or you've seen something that you're a little too afraid to speak up with, or what have you? But I've definitely noticed that. And again, I have no way to prove if that's truly the case, but this is just my own observations from having done this for a little bit and in two different places where really critically ill patients are being taken care of by similar roles.
That's a really smart observation. I'm sure there's somebody listening to this who has some database of conversations recorded about all of this, where it's generating that. Yeah. Reach out to us if you have that, because I think that's a really interesting and like super testable thing to think through in there. Yep. And like that, I would imagine that I'm actually not sure if people are aware of that and doing that consciously or blind to it, and it's just a reflexive action right in there. But that's a really smart thing to look at.
Yeah. It's funny because when I was a resident, I would actually always piss me off when they would, I didn't have this insight, of course, but it would always piss me off when like nurses would be like, they want to do this. And you're like, we are they, like, I'm standing right here. It's not they, right? Like, I'm here. But now I'm realizing that, you know, getting them on board changes that they to a we. And it gets them to buy in. It gets them to be participatory members of the patient's care team plan as opposed to spectators.
But that's just like another arc in this concept of the story about getting the duo nabs on time, right? It's moving from a mindset of, I want X. And when X doesn't happen, being like, these people are jerks and they suck and they're mean, to being like, man, this system didn't behave the way that I was expecting. That surprise is a massive signal that I don't understand things. How do I get curious and figure out what's going on in there that I don't know yet? And that's just like such an evolutionary process of coming into your own as a leader and moving from a very low level understanding of a system to a much higher level understanding of a system.
Yeah, I think that comes with just time and experience, having seen so many different variables of a lot of the same like thing. I mean, that might be a way oversimplification of it, but like I said, like it's still super critically ill patients in different areas of the hospital, but with similar care team role. And you're still somewhat seeing a lot of these themes and patterns. And as physicians, we're really good at pattern recognition. And it doesn't just apply to the disease state of the patient. It applies to human behavior and human processes and human thinking and human communication. And that's part of the reason why I'm so interested in this work and so interested in mind and things like that. Because you can just extrapolate so much more than XYZ symptoms lead to XYZ disease.
Man, I love it. Mark, thank you so much for coming on the podcast and digging into all of this. I want to give you a chance to challenge folks on the way out of this to something you want them to do differently or better on their next shift and how this impacts their clinical practice.
Yeah.
While you're thinking for a second, I'm going to put our disclaimer in, which is that nothing we do here is medical advice, right? Everything we do is trying to bring the best of what people already know out to the world. And neither myself nor my guests are speaking for anybody other than ourselves. We're just out here trying to do the best that we can.
Yeah, I think the challenge I would impose to the listeners is be very cognizant of your words and how you are communicating with other staff members, no matter who they are. That person is coming from a specific skill set and expertise that they are bringing to the betterment of the patient's care and treatment. And how you interact with them is, I think, what sets the grounds for not only subsequent interactions, but also the overall movement of a more democratic model to taking care of patients and less of a hierarchical model where it might not be safe to speak up or it might not be safe to say something. And so being very just kind, approachable, credible, humble, I think are all ways that you can better foster that open communication and safe space for others.
I love it. Mark, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure, Dan. Really appreciate it.
Thank you again for listening to our Teamcast. If you found value in this discussion, the best way to support our work and ensure you don't miss future episodes is to subscribe and leave us a quick rating or review. It'll help us reach more people who need to hear these conversations. For more on Mission Critical Team Institute, including all of our episodes and show notes, visit missioncti.com. You can also connect with us on LinkedIn. And if you're a Mission Critical Team looking to learn more about our programs, reach out directly to our Director of Operations, Ms. Janice Jackson, at janice@missioncti.com. That's JANESE@missioncti.com. Until next time, thanks.